these technological advancements will come whether we like it or not. And overall, this innovation does raise the global standard of living.
Welcome back to the Insights by Design podcast. This is episode 8, and we're joined by Jaden Schaefer. Jaden, how are you today?
I am doing fantastic. Excited to be on the show. I've been following your last couple episodes, and it's exciting stuff.
We're thrilled to have you. Michael and I have been following you for a while. We've been watching for startups. Full disclosure, I'm an investor in Jaden's most recent startup, Tiny Investor. I don't even know if it counts, but we're going to be honest here. We need Michael to be an investor. There's still a few days left, Michael. Get on the bandwagon.
Maybe after I fix my van, then I'll have a little disposable income.
Maybe you can live in your van, and then you can invest in Jaden's startup.
Genius. Live in the van, invest in the company. I like where this is going.
Well, we're very excited. Jaden's an expert on AI, AI news, and he's a founder in the AI space. So Jaden's going to be able to give us a lot of insight into what's happening on the landscape, how to build AI apps that people trust and can engage with. Before we jump into that, Jaden, for those who don't know you, can you just give a quick overview, a quick intro of who you are?
Yeah, so my background is in marketing. That's what I studied at university. I ended up teaching there as well. And since doing that, I have started some software companies. I started SelfPause, which is the number one AI life coach. So we scaled that to over 120,000 users. And then since then, I have launched AI Box, which is a no-code AI app builder and marketplace that I'm currently working on and hoping to launch shortly. And I also host the AI Chat podcast, which is one of the number one AI podcasts. Excited to be on the show.
You're so busy, and it's so fun watching everything you do. It's inspiring. It keeps me motivated because of all the projects that you're in. I can tell that you're clearly passionate about AI, but also making a positive impact in people's lives. Well, let's start talking a little bit about SelfPause. So that's your first startup, which is going extremely well. What is SelfPause?
Yeah, so originally this was a concept that my wife, Jill, thought of while she was studying computer science at university. And essentially it was originally just a positive affirmation meditation app. She had listened to a bunch of these positive affirmation meditations when she was pregnant, and it helped her out a ton. She had a ton of anxiety at the time. So after that, she was like, oh my gosh, I need to make an app for this. She was studying computer science. I had just done a lot of marketing, but I was, interested in software. So we kind of jumped in, and it was a whole journey and experience learning how to design, develop, put together this app, get investors, just the whole thing. It was an exciting experience. And then as we started seeing, getting kind of further down the road with it and started getting more users, we started to see, I had this vision. I'm like, oh my gosh, we need this to be an AI life coach. There's so much possibility there. And with a lot of the new AI tools that had come out, we decided to kind of work on that and created this whole, a bunch of different AI life coaching tools there where people can chat with them, get advice on goal setting or different areas. And so, it's kind of become, multifaceted, where essentially you can chat with an AI life coach. It can give you suggestions for different affirmations or ways to improve your mindset. And then it kind of ties into the other features of the app.
Could you talk a little bit more about the philosophy behind SelfPause? I've always been intrigued by SelfPause ever since I learned about it, because so much of technology nowadays is intended to get clicks and to make people distracted, make them jittery. But it seems that SelfPause is grounded in principles of humane technology or calm technology. What were you thinking about philosophically or conceptually as you were putting that company and that app together?
Yeah, there's a lot that goes into that. And there's a couple tricky things, because obviously when you create an app, you want it to be as addictive as possible, right? We're looking at Instagram and Facebook with bright colors and all these animations and stuff. And to some degree, there's part of me that's okay, how do we make this the shiniest thing possible? But at the same time, it's for mental health, you also want this to be a sort of a calming app where people can go and they're not it's not so flashy and stuff. So there was definitely a big balance and a lot of design decisions that we had to build around not the game, like not gamifying it too much, and a bunch of different things like that. So yeah, it's been a lot of fun in that regard. But I think that was probably really core to the philosophy, was like making sure that like when you're talking about mental health, that it has to have like a different feel or vibe than like maybe like an online game or like other, you know, things that are really focusing on engagement. But at the same time, like we want people to engage with it and use it every day. So yeah, there's a lot of that you have to think about though, for sure.
So there's a balance. And did the focus on mental health play into the aesthetics of the app at all, in some of the colors or the fonts? Tell me a little bit more about the design process. I'm so curious.
Yeah. So we went with like, it's kind of interesting because we've like obviously redesigned the whole thing, I think like two or three times. In the first version, it was like much more like bright kind of colors. And then we kind of muted it and toned it down, went with more simplistic colors. It was like a rainbow pretty much before, is like the best way to describe it. And I think probably similar to maybe what Headspace is doing now. Headspace does have like some of those more muted colors on the rainbow, whereas ours were like more brighter gradients. Anyways, it was a little bit too much, so we toned it down, chose a couple different like softer color palettes. And yeah, I mean, everything from like rounding the edges to like the ways we do the shadows, all of that is, it's like you have to think of like what's soothing and aesthetic and going to make it relaxing for someone to actually use the thing.
And how far can you go in revamping the design without losing your brand or alienating your core audience? Or does your audience just follow you from version to version, from design to design without any friction?
Yeah, I don't think that was a big problem. I think, you know, as long as the core app had the same functionalities, and, you know, like we even, you know, even on the app, we added like a bunch of new things and it did like kind of change and pivot, but we always kept the same core functionalities. So it never was like a completely new thing. And so I think, yeah, it just, they did an update and all of a sudden the app looks new, but we also tried to keep like a lot of the layout and, you know, like where you click to find things the same, so people aren't like confused. I always hate that when an app doesn't update, it's like completely refreshed and the buttons are all in different places. I'm like, come on, I don't want to have to learn this thing all over again. Like customer onboarding like a year after I got started. So we try to be like aware of that.
That's a great point. I think a lot of companies follow that strategy too. Maybe one of the most basic examples is Google. They update what Google looks like all the time, but the search bar is still smack dab in the middle of the screen. And so the essential elements are in a predictable place, but the other design elements can be played around with.
I mean, that right now.
Exactly.
And it sounds like you were able to iterate quickly and take feedback. What was your feedback loop? Were you receiving information back from customers, or was it your own introspection of just constantly reevaluating your work? What did that look like? Working harder, make it better,
do it faster, makes us stronger. Yeah, I think that there has to be like a bit of a balance in this. Because on the one hand, like I think it's like this famous thing from like Steve Jobs when he's inventing like maybe it was the iPod or the iPhone, but he's like, if you asked people what they wanted, they would tell you like they want more songs and more storage on their iPod, when in reality they want like an iPhone that can call people and do all this crazy stuff.
Would you stop thinking about what everyone wants? Stop thinking about what I want, what he wants, what your parents want. What do you want?
They, like, if you do the focus groups, they can get you so far as telling you what they want, but you also need sort of a visionary or a vision on like how to take it to the next level that your customers might not even know is possible. So I think you have to kind of have a balance to that. So we would try to come up with like, you know, like the AI aspect of it that none of our customers were asking us for that. But once we did it, a lot of them tell us how much they love it. But then at the same time, as far as like getting feedback and like knowing how to iterate and make sure it's actually what your customers want and use, I found something that was really helpful. And I've listened to a bunch of other podcasts where like I had engineering teams talk about this. And so we made sure it was like important for us. And that is that the customer service requests come into a Slack channel that me, our CPO, and our CTO are all part of. So every single customer service request, like everyone should theoretically see it. And, you know, they make tickets and figure out who's going to solve it and how they're going to do it and stuff. But every person sees every customer service request at this moment. Maybe at some point it'll get like too huge and we'll just have to like, you know, use some algorithms to say like these are the key core areas. But I remember listening to a podcast. I can't even remember the company, which kills me, but they went through Y Combinator. Anyways, what they would do is they had a solid engineering team, and they would pick one engineer a day. Their job was just to sit on the customer support team, like floor and answer phone calls.
Customer service.
Oh, yeah, I'm calling because my order hasn't arrived yet.
Sir, please calm down.
And they said that, like, more often than not, what happens is customer support would, like, go to the engineers and be like, hey, a lot of people have been complaining about X, Y, and Z. They're like, okay, we'll make a ticket. We'll get around to it. But they said, like, if it was something easy and a lot of people were calling that engineer, they're just like, oh, fine. And they just, like, sit there and, like, hack it out and just, like, fix it right there. And they said that that was actually, like, a huge improvement to getting, like, the things that people really cared about fixed very quickly. So I always thought that that was kind of a cool way to go.
That is an amazing way to go. Just thinking about, I only have one startup that I've worked for, and there was always a barrier in between engineering and the customer. Like, engineers were not speaking directly to the customer, right? There might be a product manager or customer service person. There's a filter in between. And then, you know, creating some ticket, putting it in ServiceNow hell.
Damn it.
And maybe the engineers prioritize it, maybe they don't. So building that empathy in the engineering team is such a great strategy.
And I think Jaden brought up a great point that you need to listen to your users and involve them in the feedback process. But there's also limits to what users can tell you. And there's a Simpsons clip that I showed to my class about when Homer was put in charge of designing a new automobile. He's bossing around the engineers. He's bossing around the designers. And in the end, did it work?
The Homer.
No, it's like this terrible thing that costs thousands and thousands of dollars that nobody's going to buy. But I think it reinforces Jaden's point that you want to build empathy. You want to gather feedback from lots of different angles. But you need to be careful about who has decision-making power, and you might need to elevate people's vision to what's possible, as opposed to just having people ask for a faster horse or a bigger cup holder or more storage space on the existing technologies. So that's a balance that I think a lot of analysts and designers need to strike.
100%, yeah.
Because then you're not an order taker. That's what I tell my teams at ASU when stakeholders come to them with a request. I'm like, your job is to understand needs and then to link it up with our capabilities. Your job isn't to collect solutions from the stakeholder. Because often, you know, they'll come to you and like, I need this solution built this way. I'm like, okay, build it yourself. Because that's not what we do. We're consultants, right? Where our job is to get deep, understand needs, and then to provide you the best possible solution to meet those needs. And then to iterate quickly if we weren't accurate in assessing those needs. But you brought up an amazing point, Jaden, about not gamifying, really thinking through like the ethics of self-help. And we saw issues with that with like Robinhood's app, where they really gamified financial services and stock trading, and then they got in trouble for that. And like every time you bought stock, you know, you swipe up and then it gives you this big celebration.
It's so comfortable. I feel like I can sit.
And I loved that. So like when they got in trouble from whatever the SEC, I was like, oh, come on. I love the confetti. That was my favorite part of buying a stock.
There's a lot of people's favorite part. That was the problem. But how do you think about ethics in terms of AI? What runs through your mind?
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot that can go into that. And there's a lot of different areas. I think overall, when you're building AI or using AI tools, the most important thing is to like focus on like what is net positive for humanity, for the end user. Think about that. Now, I think there's a lot of ways you can go with ethics. I think that there's like a whole segment of people right now that are saying AI and a lot of things in AI are unethical because they're taking people's jobs, and so that's harmful for people and et cetera. I tend to be in the camp that believes that like these technological advancements will come whether we like it or not. And overall, this innovation does raise the global standard of living. I'm sure when the dishwasher came out, all of the hand dishwashing people in restaurants complained and were worried they'd lose their job. You don't lose your job. You shift, you change, you upskill.
Media immediately goes to, well, this will have very negative impacts on the job ecosystem, and there'll be a lot of people who are laid off, and this could result in very bad things. And then what we generally find is that it creates more jobs than it destroys.
So I think things change. And so in that regard, I'm not so concerned about what maybe others are concerned about as far as ethics go. But what I am more concerned about is making sure that as we train these AI models and we create these like really robust, powerful solutions, that we're making sure like they are aligning with like humanity's values. I've found a couple instances and reported on them where this was not the case. And it's alarming to me when I start seeing AI integrated into healthcare and the military and other like, you know, very highly critical areas where human lives are at, you know, stake. And it would feel like the AI model does not value that as highly as I think it should. So there's those issues that I also think about a lot.
And Michael and I do focus on the AI in the healthcare space, and it's figuring out like, where's the human in the loop? Like, are we removing the human in the loop, or are we just optimizing the human in the loop? And those ethical questions often fall under regulation. How do you feel about regulation in the AI space?
I know everyone has different opinions on this. I'm also like a deregulationist sort of, and I'm sure I get heat for that a lot. I just think that maybe regulation, there are some good places for regulation in AI. I tend to think we're a little bit early and we risk deregulating or like overregulating at the moment. I know that that's controversial. I don't have their own opinion on that, but I look at like what the EU does and they are faster to create a regulation around AI than they are to create a home run. So they do have Mistral AI that has come out of France that is an amazing model. But before that, like really took off and raised billions, they literally had the EU AI Act that had come out. So sometimes I just worry, like I don't want our society to be one that like creates the regulation before the tool's even there and you know what it's really capable of. So yeah, I know that's controversial, but I'm not a huge regulation guy.
So you suggested that regulation runs the risk of stifling innovation. But isn't it possible that regulation could also help create a more level playing field so that we don't get just massive AI company monopolies gobbling up all of the competition and outsourcing their innovation to the little guys before they take the little guys over?
This is a argument that I actually hear from a lot of lawyers in the AI space, because what they say is, well, if you create the regulation, and it's not so much about the monopoly thing. I actually think it's the opposite from monopoly, but that's just me. But they say that if you create the regulation, then big companies with big budgets are like, okay, look, it's clear cut. We're not going to worry about wasting money. We can plow more funding into this because we know it's like, we know what the regulations are. We know what the limits are. So I've talked to a lot of lawyers like in the AI space that have said that regulation spurs innovation. Okay, that's one way to look at it. And also your definition of innovation. There's a lot of things that go into this. And I know like my opinion is going to be different than a lot of people on this. I get into arguments on LinkedIn or conversations on LinkedIn about this. So like I know like I'm a little maybe far out on some of this. But this is what I think about the monopoly thing. I'm convinced that like OpenAI going to Congress and asking for more regulation is, in my opinion, a form of regulatory capture where they're trying to pull the ladder up. They've already scraped everyone's data off the entire internet without consent, used it to train a model, and are making $1 billion off of it. And now they're like, and we need to have regulation where you submit your model to Congress. It's like,
so okay, that other so people can't do it.
Yeah, exactly. So it's harder for startups to do it. Anyway, so in that regard, I can see a little bit of what I think is regulatory capture or an attempt at it. There's definitely more multiple sides of that argument.
So if you think about it, do you see evidence, Jaden, that people working in the AI space are capable of self-regulation? Because that could be one way to reassure government regulators that they don't need to overstep, that they don't need to stifle, that they don't need to capture what's already going on. Have any companies taken any significant measures to show that they're capable of self-restraint or self-regulation?
Yeah, I think after the EU AI Act, a lot of companies in the United States have been very vocal about this. So Anthropic was a company who, like from the beginning, they're like, we're making safe AI. They didn't even just like define exactly what that was at the beginning. They've been better at that now. But that was just like their ethos, right? They're making safe AI. And so I think that they got a lot of traction because of that. They also got a lot of traction because Sam Bankman-Fried gave them a couple $100 billion. But, you know, regardless, irrelevant of that situation, which I think is funny. This is funny because FTX said they could pay back all of their investors that lost money. And I think it's literally because the investment they made into Anthropic has now gone up so much. Anyways, that's another story. So Anthropic is a good company that has been doing this and kind of focusing on this. But I've seen most AI companies now coming up with like safety standards. And
safety first, dude. You're cutting.
Oh.
Yeah, there you go.
And like a safety like document that they point to, because they don't, they want to, regardless of what they're doing, they want to look like they're being responsible so that, you know, they don't get regulated. Now, you could contrast that maybe to a company like Midjourney that has gotten a lot of criticism for their data set, for taking all the artists' art, for creating what they've done and how they've done it. So, yeah, I think those are kind of the two different sides of that and how it's being done. So startups, in my opinion right now, it seems they're a little bit like these like renegade pirates. I mean, you look at like what Midjourney's done and scooped up everyone's art. And I get into, this is probably one that's most controversial. People are, there's a lot of people that really don't like Midjourney, because if you look at it from just a perspective of which AI image generator does the best job, I've never seen Midjourney beaten. Like, it's gotten close. Like DALL-E 3 is not bad from OpenAI. It's actually pretty good, and I use it because it's more accessible. But and then there's like Adobe Firefly. There's like a bunch of different ones that are doing pretty good. Meta even has a good one. But like Midjourney is still like the best. But a lot of people are mad about like their data sets, where they got their content from, artists and royalties and rights. Because you have like Adobe, who, you know, essentially they created their image generator and they built it off of their own stock image portfolio and pay royalties to the creators. It's kind of funny how they do it. It's not exactly science, but they do pay royalties, and so you can see like, oh look, they're going in like a positive direction with this, for if that's like really what you care about. Whereas Midjourney is just like, you know, we have the best image generator and we made it. What really triggers people is when I post on LinkedIn and say Midjourney is now worth $100 million or generates $100 million without taking any investor money. And without any investments, people get very triggered by that, because obviously they just took everyone's art in the whole world and used that for their platform.
With online music streaming, audio streaming, right? Like, the artists weren't getting paid for that initially. And then they came to a collective bargaining agreement where they pay out the labels, right? So we may see something like that in terms of AI.
Yeah.
But with you being a startup founder in the AI space and building AI Box, do those underlying concerns of the data and the regulations on the training data concern you, or will they impact you at all?
I mean, I'll definitely say, I think the job of a AI founder today in large part is like staying very up to date with what is going on with AI and regulation, whether that directly impacts me or impacts the companies I use. So for AI Box specifically, right? So we're a no-code AI app builder and marketplace. We essentially allow you to link together multiple AI models that you would typically use to do your workflows and automate your tasks with those models. Then you can post them on a marketplace if you create tools, and you get a royalty when people use them. So if, let's say, they change the regulation on how, you know, an AI image generating company had to compensate creators, like, that wouldn't directly impact us, because that would be between Midjourney and the people that they have used art from to like figure out that compensation package. But I mean, it would probably increase the cost of using Midjourney, and maybe, I mean, in a crazy world, Midjourney gets completely banned and we'd have to pull them off our platform. So like, there's like things like that can happen. But I think largely speaking, what we're specifically building is fairly insulated, because we are not the AI company for most of what we're doing. Now, we'll have some stuff in the future that dabbles more in that area, but at the moment, it's not there. But regardless, I think it's definitely an area that I stay up to date on, because it impacts, whether, even if it's not directly me, like my vendors or the people on my platform, and that impacts what I can create on the platform.
Love it. So just case study to make sure I understand. Again, I believe in the business model. I'm a tiny investor in it. Love what you're doing. But let's say I'm building on AI Box, a AI app that will make automated phone calls on my behalf as part of my automation of my tasks. FCC just recently banned AI-generated robocalls. I'm the one who is responsible for taking that down, and that's between me and the FCC, because you're the marketplace. You're like the app store. You're not responsible or liable for that. Is that the stance?
I think that we will have some liability or some role in like making sure that apps are posted, that like Apple App Store, you know, if there's a scam app, mm-hmm. or They actually, I don't think they're liable, to be honest, because there's been a bunch of scam apps on the Apple App Store. And when they find him, of course, they ban him, delete him. They don't try to let him get past. It's not good for their ecosystem. But I don't think you can sue Apple if you downloaded an app. It's like it was the app. It was the company that did it. So I think that it's probably more that. But we'll do our best. Now, I mean, in regards to the FTC and banning robocalls.
Come quietly or there will be trouble.
What? This is something I looked into that announcement, by the way. And it's actually very deceiving. All of the headlines say FTC bans AI-generated robocalls. What they actually did is ban AI-generated robocalls for illegal purposes.
No.
So already illegal. It's pretty much like they said, it's illegal to rob the bank with a machete. Yeah, it was already illegal to rob the bank, but it's definitely illegal to rob it with a machete. So anyways, that one's kind of a little deceiving. I think you're still going to get a lot of AI-generated robocalls as long as they're not doing something illegal. Impersonating someone or asking you for money or scamming you, they actually are still legal. So anyways, that's in regards to that. But yeah, I think overall it's still, oh, and in addition to that, like if something like that were illegal, I think even the AI model itself would have to take steps to try to make sure that their model is being used correctly. So it's probably falls in responsibility somewhere between the three parties.
Yeah, immediately when I saw that announcement, and clearly I didn't read the fine print because I just read the headlines. I was like, oh, there goes 20 startups business models like immediately. They're all AI generated robocalls. So with AI Box, it sounds like there's two main components. It's both the marketplace and but it's also this low or this no code, you said, AI building platform. Tell us about that. That's really interesting.
Yeah, that's actually like honestly what I'm the most excited about, the most innovative and like useful part. The marketplace is exciting and it's a way for people to monetize, make money, et cetera. So I think that's awesome and great. And I think that'll fuel a lot of the growth. But like what I'm literally excited about is the app builder, because this is something that I have personally wanted. We essentially started this because after ChatGPT dropped, I was coming up with like, and we'd already had self-pause and we'd created like kind of this AI life coach for it. And it was like amazing. And then all of a sudden when ChatGPT dropped, I was like, there is literally like, I was coming up with like 10 new AI startups every single day. And I was sending them to my friend who's now the CTO of AI Box. And I was like, hey, like, what if we did this? What if we did this? We could create this. And I was asking about the tech viability about all of these, right? And eventually it got to the point where he's like, hey, like, we can't build all 100 of these things. Let's just build a platform that allows you to chain together your prompts, chain together your AI models. And you'll be able to just like create people, anyone will be able to create these tools. So that's really what we started to do. It's been really phenomenal for myself. I even in like the marketing efforts or a lot of the different like business efforts inside of like building up self-pause or building up AI Box, I've essentially like on the platform, which isn't released for everyone yet, but of course I have access to it. I've created like a number of these like automated workflows, and I'll just get a virtual assistant to go on and I'll be like, hey, like every week we're sending out this specific newsletter, go on, click this button. It's going to add the links from this specific source. It's going to spit it out. And then you can like, it just in one click, you're going to generate like the whole newsletter and you just go like run that workflow. And so it's been amazing because in the past, you either had to have an employee do that whole process and we did, and we paid people. We actually saved a lot of money after like starting developing AI Box. I kind of moved away and had my CTO who now runs self-pause, but we were able to eliminate a lot of the tasks that were being done within self-pause because of AI Box, right? So I think that will be something that we're going to see more and more. I even saw on LinkedIn News today, it's like AI might already be impacting layoffs. Like without a doubt, AI is, you know, contributing to a lot of layoffs. You can become more productive as a company and not lay people off, or if you need to save money, you can lay people off and AI can help you. In any case, yeah, it's amazing. I've been able to create these tools. Or when you're starting, it also helps you expedite scaling up a new company, right? Because AI Box, we had no employees and I was able to create a bunch of these boxes, hire a virtual assistant to just go in and do certain tasks. And I know for a fact, no matter where in the world they're from, no matter how good their English is, like I have a prompt and I have the data source and I make them a template so they know how to create the output and they can do the whole process. I'm never worried about grammar errors or like design errors or like anything because everything's encapsulated in this little in this workflow. They just have to like run it and post it and schedule it and make sure like that sort of element of it is done so I don't have to, but like otherwise the whole thing is like completed, done, and for repetitive tasks it's like an absolute lifesaver.
So to break down the value proposition of AI Box really simply, it sounds like you're basically giving users a box of Legos and then letting them put the Legos together however they want and then sell their creations to other users. Is that basically it?
Yeah, exactly. So it's amazing for, like, of course, my background's in marketing, so I'm always, like, biased towards all of the marketing and content kind of creation pieces. But I've had people talk to me about, like, data analysis and about customer service use cases, and, like, there's just, like, a million use cases. But, yeah, it's you essentially create, like, a workflow that can accomplish a certain output for you or do a certain task, and then, yeah, you can sell that to other people to use.
But I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about how you assemble effective teams as an entrepreneur. You mentioned that you've worked with Jill. You mentioned that the CTO of AI Box is your friend. Isn't it kind of hazardous to go into business with a family member or with a friend? How do you know?
Well, yeah, I mean, as far as friends go, friends, connection. I mean, I think I have a big network of very talented people, and I'll feel lucky if I can, you know, include them in what I'm working on. So I think that's definitely one area. But yeah, I mean, as far as building teams go, a majority of everyone that has worked at most of my companies, some of my best people have been like referrals from people I know. I found some really great people. My CTO for SelfPause was like a connection from one of our investors, had him in one of their in a course or a thing that they were doing, or maybe one of, I think his wife, anyways, they found out about him and sent him over, and he's been like phenomenal. I really think asking your network for recommendations is like one of the best ways to find people. Now, I do know like at some point you have to scale beyond that so you can use recruitment firms or like other things. One other thing that I will say though, for startups specifically, that I think is 100% possible today, you can build some incredible startups using a combination. I literally think this is like a secret sauce. And I don't just think this is like if you're really super, super scrappy. I think anyone can and should do this. An amazing combination of virtual assistants and AI tools. So you can pay someone however much money you want to pay them to be an expert in a certain area and create like a workflow, even if that's not on AI Box. Like it just happens to be a glue layer that chains it together nicely, but you could just have a document that says, go to ChatGPT with this prompt, ask for this thing, then go to Descript with this, ask for this thing, then go here and run the data through this and get this, right? So get someone that's an expert, right? For all intents and purposes, they could be getting paid $200,000 a year or $400,000 a year at a huge tech company to do something incredible. Get them to create like a process like that, and you can get a virtual assistant or someone much cheaper to run that process. Now, I think for startups, this is gold because essentially you can use consultants to help you come up with a process, and then you can go to much cheaper labor to fulfill that process. And I think that's also an amazing way to scale today. This is like something as of the last year, this is a strategy that's very viable. I'm seeing companies that are funded by like Andreessen Horowitz using some of these strategies. So like, I think it's very viable today. And I think you'll see a lot more of these, especially today. Like, gone are the days of like the ZERP era, zero interest rate, tons of money for startups. Like, now people really care about getting your startup to profitability, being as lean as possible. You know, make this thing's got to actually make money.
I love that. And I feel like that's a trend we're seeing a lot, is abstracting away a lot of the dirty work and into a workflow. And in AI Box, but it sounds like it's containerized tasks or code, and then you can chain those together so you can containerize the process. Now I'm thinking through this, so I'll probably edit this out, but it sounds like you're containerizing a specific process, and then you can link that to another container and then to another container. Is that how you're doing that?
Yeah, we have like a bunch of tools and software, and obviously I'm also not the developer, so I can't tell you exactly how the code is written. But yeah, we essentially have API access to a bunch of different AI models. And then we have like a visual builder that allows you to kind of chain together all of the different models. And yeah, essentially it will run one task on one AI model, take the output for that and use it as a variable and input it into the next AI model, which will run it, link it to another one. And then we have kind of an end source where they all merge together.
I love that. You're the Zapier for AI.
Exactly. Yeah.
It's a beautiful business model.
Yeah, I think with... the no-code part of AI Box is really exciting because as a Python camp dropout, I'm really interested in AI, but I don't know a lot of tools out there that, I don't know, bloggerize, just make it really push button or really accessible. So I think the mission of democratizing AI and making it more accessible to a greater number of people is really intriguing.
You've been working on this for quite a while, and then OpenAI dropped their GPT marketplace. What's the moat between what you're doing and what the GPT marketplace is?
Yeah, I think one of the biggest differences, we were actually really excited because we've been working on this for like a year. So when the GPT marketplace, the GPT store kind of was announced, we're like, so many people that were like, oh, I don't know if this is going to be the way the future of everything's going. We're like, yes, this is obviously the direction OpenAI is focusing on it. You also have Hugging Face, who is doing something similar. You also have Chorus Poe, which is doing something similar. They all do different aspects of this. And I do believe there will be many different marketplaces that focus on different niches and different areas in this. What I will say is, like, at a very basic level, what we're building is with AI Box, you can imagine it to be more like a Canva versus what someone else might be trying to build with an Adobe Photoshop. So we're really trying to be the simplest no-code place that's very visual, very easy for anyone that is not a developer. There's other tools out there that also do some similar things, but they're like developer focused. You got to like look through your code and tweak your code. Like, I don't want code shown anywhere on this tool. I'm not a developer. So like, I am my own customer. I just want it to be as clean and simple for anyone to build as possible. I think this is why ChatGPT was so successful. And then as far as the GPT store, I mean, one of the main obvious differences is that OpenAI is just going to allow you to use OpenAI tools on there, right? They're not going to have Google Bard or Meta's Lambda on there when you're creating these GPTs, because that defeats the purpose of, you know, that they created a product exclusively to promote their own stuff. I've also had the head of developer relations on my podcast for OpenAI and talked to him about that, and that's really their direction. So on AI Box, the beauty of the product there is that it's model agnostic, meaning you could create a whole workflow and tool, and then all of a sudden you say, hey, looks like Meta just came out with like a way better version and OpenAI is lagging. Like, let's say this happens in the future. You could just go and change the model that's running a specific prompt, and all of a sudden your whole tool is now updated to whatever the latest and greatest AI tool is. You're not getting like locked in. You don't have to call your developers and be like, hey, we're going to make a big switch, change all of the OpenAI to Meta and change all of the mid journeys to DALL-E 3. Like, you can just go make all those changes very quickly. I think that's something that people will like, is having access to thousands of the top AI models instead of, you know, one specific company, which is what you'll see from OpenAI.
I love it. Very exciting things you're doing, Jaden. Thank you so much for your time. We'll link your podcast, your LinkedIn, and AI Box and the funding page on Republic below. Thank you so much. I hope you have a great day.